part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. Fanboy.com.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you, man?
Good. I'm doing okay. Hanging in there. Getting through the day.
Know the feeling.
Well, at least, you know, when times get rough, we can always read Preacher and
exactly
and feel better.
All right.
Yeah. Everything feels better when you're reading Preacher.
So much better.
Oh, okay. Well, this is Christian Horn, and this is Part-Time Fanboy, and I am here once again with my friend Jason Holtham.
Hello.
And we are here once again to discuss the next arc of Preacher.
I've been
gone for like 3 weeks. This is like actually 2 weeks. This seems to be, I was going through the website and it seems April seems to be the month where I sort of slack off the most the past couple of years, where I take like two weeks or something and don't do anything. So
doesn't your daughter have a spring break around now? I mean, that's gotta be part of it.
I mean, generally spring break was like, for some reason it was like in March this year. Tends to be in March in LA. I don't know. I just kind of got burnt out with a lot of things and needed to take a couple of weeks off. And so now we're back. Preacher, the show, is right around the corner. So coming in May, I don't think we're going to finish the whole series, you know, before the show starts. But in any case, I just want to read the damn thing anyway.
Oh my God. It's so much fun to read. It's always so much fun to read.
It's so excellent. I mean, at this point, what the chapter we are discussing is, I think it's issues 13 through 18, and it's called Hunters. And it says on the cover of issue 13 that it is one of four, but there's four issues and there's an epilogue. I guess last we left them, you know, Jesse and Tulip had just survived Anvil, correct?
That's right. They just left Anvil. They were still in Anvil. The last we saw them was them kissing in front of the burning remains of his grandmother's house.
That's right. And they had basically survived an attack by Jesse's family, who turned out to be a bunch of crazy redneck nut jobs.
Loons.
Yeah, loons.
Violent loons.
That is a very generous word for these people. Like, that's, we can't even get into how bad, like, you can't use four letter words for these people. We cannot. So at this point, I mean, you know, they almost get right to it because the next chapter opens up with the Saint of Killers basically having tracked them down to Anvil.
That's right.
I love that line.
Not bad for a beginner. Destruction.
Exactly. He's looking at the destruction that Jesse and Tulip have left behind, the burned house and everything. What was that guy's name? Jody.
Jody's rotting corpse.
Rotting corpse. Yeah, and he's like, not bad for a beginner. So, I mean, that sets you up very much because you don't see him for the rest of this arc, but it reminds you that, this guy is still out there.
That's right.
Looking
still on
them.
The trail.
And it's not good. It's kind of a neat reminder of like, oh, their troubles are not over. Like, it kind of ended on a happy note, but oh, wait, there's more. And it's, there's a lot more coming. But this arc doesn't really have anything to do with the Saint of Killers or Anvil. Nope. It's sort of them reconnecting with Cassidy, really.
That's right?
Right.
It's mostly about Cassidy, but it is also sort of the, I would say it's the next major turn in the series.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a big turn for them because at this point now they're Tulip and Jesse are romantically involved. Like they're full on in. There's none of the sort of silly bitterness or moonlighting stuff that was kind of going on. Like, will they or won't they? They're definitely doing it. And, you know, and you find them in a hotel room in San Francisco.
That's right.
And they're basically screwing like bunnies for God knows how many days.
Days on end. Days on end, eating pizza and room service and making apparently terrific amounts of noise.
Yeah, exactly. Which the bellhop complains and Jesse bribes him. Yeah. That's a great little bit right there. He's like, yeah, that's not going to happen. The bellhop. So, the people have been complaining about the noise. He's like, yeah, you're just going to have to deal with it.
there's going to be a lot more of them.
Yep. And and I mean, this first chapter called Came a Pale Rider. Well, I mean, this whole thing is like, first of all, it's like, I think this is like really, I mean, there were sort of hints of it in the arc, like two arcs ago, like before the Anvil arc. But this is sort of the arc where you really get like the humor starts to, the dark, like really dark humor. I mean, there's hints of it before. And then the crazy sort of like sexuality that is involved in the book, which is almost sort of like, would you call it farcical?
Or it gets pretty farcical. I mean, it gets really, really comical and definitely over the top.
Yeah,
like unbelievably over the top.
Yeah,
until it gets very, very dark, as we will see shortly.
Yeah.
Oof. Yeah, really dark.
Well, I'm looking at the spread, the full page spread, for lack of a better term.
Splash page.
Because basically the splash page. But I didn't, when I went to reread this, and I'm sure the first time I read it, this guy, oh God, what's the character's name? I'm blanking out.
Oh God, what is it? Hold on.
Well, the freak in charge, the basically. He's basically they're in San Francisco. This guy's like a very rich guy who holds crazy orgies for very rich people.
Yep.
And basically he's in bed naked with a bunch of other people, but there's a bunny rabbit with a little carrot in the bed with him. And I'm like, what is that? Yeah. But, what is this character's name? It's going to bug me. But anyway,
it's something classical. It comes up, I think, in the next.
It's like Jesus Desaad. Yeah, that's
Jesus
it.
Desaad.
Yeah. Like as if you couldn't combine like two crazier names like together.
Oh my God.
It's like a perfect. It's totally Ennis's perfect sense of humor there, where it's like, I'm going to take the most screwed up guy and the most like, you know, sacred thing, and I'm going to stick them together into one name. And
I think actually it's Jesus. I think he's actually Jesus.
Oh, you think he's Jesus? You think it pronounces it like that?
He's looking at it. It's got the accent on it.
The
accent in there. So I believe that he is actually Jesus. It's all terrible.
Well, you basically you're introduced to him and they don't really hold back. Like you're getting the sense that this guy holds these orgies for like rich and powerful people. He likes it to be a big event, like a really big deal. He's trying to score some heroin. And with this scene, I mean, they very much established that he's basically into everything.
Yes.
And the way that they established that is that his butler brings him something to pleasure himself with, and it's a little armadillo.
It's an armadillo.
And it's so sad because the armadillo doesn't even know that it's about to get buggered or whatever. It's going to have, and it makes this noise like,
oh my God.
And it's just like,
suggesting that he's already buggered his way through all of the larger quadrupeds at the zoo.
Oh, geez.
As well as most of the petting zoo. Like, oh my God.
Yeah. And that's definitely where you start realizing, like, I mean, that's for me is like sort of kind of the big moment where like, okay, we're going there. Like before in the arc where they were in New York and they ran into all that, there was a little bit of that, but this is like hardcore. And they, I wouldn't even say it was sexual deviance in the first one. It was just kind of like, this is like really like, okay, we're going full throttle here, kids.
Yes, this is definitively and decidedly not for children.
not even close. Which to me is really gets my brain going because I'm very much like, what? How is the show even gonna touch any of this? It probably won't. I can't imagine that it will, but
I mean, I think. My sense of it is, I think I don't know how they're going to deal with it when they get to this. Like, this is crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And this is just the tip of this iceberg, in this arc alone, which just opens a door to such deviant, disturbing, but also really, really funny. I mean, that's the thing that is sort of great about this, that most of this, deviancy, for lack of a better word, is mostly played for laughs.
Oh yeah, big time. But that's the thing is that and as you see like later in this arc, there's definitely a line that gets crossed where it's like, yeah, it's all fun and games up until you realize that there are victims sometimes. And what's really funny is that not funny but kind of odd in a way is that how like you can sort of take the animal victimization as humorous in a way, but once it gets to, and you know, I'll just jump to it, like they sort of insinuate that children are being harmed at these orgies, like that's where it's like and it's just that's where it's sort of, and that's kind of like what's brilliant about this series in a way is that they approach stuff with so much humor and then they'll cross a serious line and you're like, oh no. Like, you know, and Ennis knows that it's a serious line. He knows that like I'm going to do this and I'm about to change the tone of what you're reading. And it's like, it's brilliant the way he does it because it sneaks up on you, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it just comes out of nowhere because you're like, you're sort of having a good time. This is fun. Ha ha ha. And then it's like, oh no. I don't want to have anything to do with that. You know what I mean? Not that I want to have anything to do with buggering animals, but you know what I mean? It's sort of like played for laughs in a way, you know?
You can totally laugh at the little sounds that Aardvark makes and the idea that this guy is actually somehow going to find a way to sodomize an armadillo. And like it's all fun and games until it's not fun and games.
Absolutely.
And like he's so over the top. Like everything, all of his threats, everything about him is like so drenched in this over the top sexuality.
Yeah.
That you can't take him seriously until later on, you very much have to. You know.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're totally 100% right. As I'm kind of like looking through, particularly this issue, you're right. It really does open up a lot of stuff. Like, I mean, it hides us in this Jesus de Sade sort of storyline, but this is the issue where you really get introduced to the big conspiracy. That's coming, that sort of like wraps up a huge chunk of the series.
Yeah.
And sort of like the dynamics between, you know, Cassidy and Tulip and Jesse, the way that they're all going to sort of play out.
Yeah. I mean, all of those pieces start being laid here really, really nicely. We are like two pages away from the introduction of one of my favorite characters from all of comic book history, and who is essentially the big bad for the rest of the show, the series.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It's interesting because you get introduced to, Featherstone and Hoover, who are sort of like the Laurel. It's funny because they talk about Laurel and Hardy in this arc too.
Mm-hmm.
And Featherstone and Hoover are very much that sort of like when Jesse and, because a lot of this arc is also Tulip and Jesse reconnecting with Cassidy in San Francisco. And their relationship with Cassidy is sort of what sets the action in motion. But they have like a really good, and I happen to agree with them, they have like a really good conversation about Laurel and Hardy. I love Laurel and Hardy. And, you know, it's interesting. I realize now looking through this issue that sort of, at least for this arc, you know, Featherstone and Hoover are very much Laurel and Hardy. Like Hoover is, you know, Stan Laurel, and, you know, she's Hardy, you know, and she's the angry one that's always like, what are you doing? Like rolling her eyes at him. Yep. And he's the one that's always kind of like bouncing around and getting into, wow, that's really interesting. The first time I ever realized it.
Yeah. That, and that's very much the way that they serve most of the rest of the book. I mean, and even in terms of the look, like it's not as stark, but you know, Featherstone, or which one? Yeah, no, Hoover is definitely drawn as the portly one, while she's the skinny, angular one.
Yeah, definitely.
And they are definitely comic relief for a time.
Yeah, so physically, I think they might have flipped it, but, you know, I definitely see Hoover as the as sort of the Laurel and the Laurel and Hardy.
Right.
He's always bumbling around, screwing things up. You know, and she's very much a look at this mess that you've gotten us into.
Exactly.
You know,
she's the acerbic one who can curse.
Yeah, exactly. Uses the MF word, and he's always like, Featherstone. Like, that's a great, really great touch. But yeah, I mean, you're right. In this particular issue, this is the issue where Herr Starr makes his first appearance.
Yes, but before we get to that, there's one not exactly loose end, but one important sort of bit here that's part of all this is that happens, you know, and it sort of hides it in a scene where Tulip's boobs are just hanging out the entire time. But we do have to discuss the fact that they did find God for the first time, and that God resurrected Tulip. After she was shot in the head. And they have a discussion here about what, again, are they on this plan to find God and make him take responsibility for his creation?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, I really like the little bit of dialogue where, you know, they're talking about what was it like to get shot in the head and stuff. Mm-hmm. And she's like, she talks about God in a way that, you know, he's very much wants to be liked. Or seem to be like, it's like a generous or like caring thing. And it's just, it's an interesting concept to see like a God who, I don't know what you would call that, like an insecurity complex or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so dull and like a little, like a weird little old man.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it's a really good way of catching everyone up too. Ennis found a really good way of, not doing what Marvel used to do, or DC Comics, like in the 60s or 70s, where they would literally, the dialogue would just be like somebody recapping like the last couple of issues. But this is very much conversational and really natural, the way that they talk. Yeah.
Oh, the dialogue in this book is so well written and so well structured, and it's just great the entire time. And even the subtleties of the art, because again, talking about, we're moving into a point where the sort of plot points start piling up quickly.
Yeah.
I love this last panel here on page 9, the really nicely drawn difference between Jesse's warm, affectionate smile at the thought of Cassidy and Tulip's apprehension at being around Cassidy. And the beginning of that issue, which eventually becomes a major point in the sort of latter half of the series.
Yeah. It's really interesting because, I mean, I remember when I originally read it, it was very much like, well, what is the deal? Like, is she like jealous of the best? Like, I couldn't figure out like what her, I mean, obviously Cassidy was like a vampire. So I always thought that she was like freaked out by that, but it's definitely that sort of thing where, you know, your wife or your girlfriend has better intuition about somebody than you do. And like down the line, it really plays out. And it's very funny too, because there's also that scene where they finally meet up with Cassidy in the bar, and mm-hmm. they end towards the end of the evening, and they go outside and they get a picture taken. And yeah. it's like sort of like a special moment. It's like, for lack of a better term, it's like they're sort of their last moment of innocence before like yep. all this stuff is like it hasn't been crazy before, but like yep. where all the stuff is really, really just going to get crazy between the three of them, you know?
Yep. And yeah, they, it's so great. And they, you know, that picture in particular becomes a sort of totem for that pops up a couple of times.
Yeah.
In the rest of the, just this particular moment and this moment of Jesse in the collar and the three of them all smiling, outside yep. of this punk rock club. That's really great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of like, yeah, reestablishing stuff, but introducing sort of like new ideas in this first issue, and you know, the very quick introduction of Star, you know, which
yes,
you know, he basically blows somebody's head off. He's only in this issue, it looks like, for 2 pages.
That's all.
He gets introduced and he blows somebody's head off, and then he sort of lays out the sort of the fact that there is this whole organization and yep. that there is a conspiracy within the organization yep. to you don't know exactly what. I mean, do they talk about like no, they don't really talk about the master nope. plan. But
nope, they don't get into the details of the plan here. We just now know that there's an organization called the Grail.
Yeah.
Which we did get at the end of the first arc for a single panel.
Yeah.
The suggestion that the like of things to come, that there was this thing called the Grail. And now we know a little bit more about them. They all wear white suits with red either ties or shirts.
Yes.
Except for Hair Star.
Yeah, except for Hair Star.
Who yeah. gets to wear a badass black overcoat because yes. black overcoats are the best.
Yes.
And that he has been leading a plot within the Grail to undermine whatever it's been protecting for 2,000 years.
Exactly. Exactly. And they're looking for Jesse. That's established. So that's like sort of the bad news there. And then, you know, the rest of this particular issue is really Jesse and Cassidy sort of like reconnecting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
yep.
this is where the Laurel and Hardy conversation takes place.
Yeah.
And this is where they get into the bar fight, where yep. it's just like a huge bar fight. And yeah, and there's something else that happens, you know, because remember in the beginning of the series, like, Cassidy said, like, had the word used on him. Jesse yep. used the word on him, and Cassidy's like, don't ever do that again. And Cassidy gets stabbed in this particular bar fight, and he goes to bite somebody, and Jesse has to use yeah. the word again. But this time, Cassidy is not that ticked about it. Like, yeah. it's almost like he accepts it. He's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, Jesse is deeply apologetic for having done it, and he recognizes the reason that Jesse would use it, which we come to also in the end of the next page, as to why I think why Cassidy would be more understanding, because Cassidy's sort of running off the rails here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And running off the rails because his girlfriend has died.
Yeah, yeah, and, yeah.
You know, and I think Cassidy is also aware that he needed to be stopped.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that is sort of the little bit that sort of sets everything into motion as far as,
yep.
you know, their narrative is concerned, right? Because
yeah.
they... I mean, this arc becomes, or at least... what leads them to Jesus de Sade and, mm-hmm. you know, the Grail too, because the Grail ends up becoming involved,
yep.
is the fact that Cassidy's girlfriend died because of a heroin overdose, right. correct? And she right. was meant to deliver it to de Sade. And the next issue is when we get introduced to the people who gave not very intelligently, gave her the heroin to deliver.
Exactly. Gave a junkie of some very, very high-end heroin.
Yes.
But we have in a way, I mean, not so much that Jesse and Cassidy are a Laurel and Hardy pair, but now we have at least our second Laurel and Hardy pair of this book.
Sure.
Glover and Allen.
Yes. Bob Glover and Freddie.
Sexual investigations.
Yeah, exactly. Which is like, what is that? You know what I mean? It's like, what is that? I don't even okay, so investigating what? Like, yeah, it's hysterical. That is hysterical.
Oh my God. And oh my God. Just, and the two of them are hysterical and bizarre. Yes. And again, this is this intense parody, like, parody-esque, because it's just over the top ridiculousness of everything. For some reason they're English. I don't know why.
Exactly. Or is he Scottish? Is he British? Oh, I don't know what his accent is. Bob's accent.
I think Bob is meant to have like a lower class, like a Cockney accent.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, you're right. Looking at the issue now. But yeah, they're basically introduced, and you're right, you're absolutely right. This is sort of less charismatic sort of Laurel and Hardy pairing than the first two, than Featherstone and Hoover. But it's really funny stuff. But then it's really funny because you get introduced to them and you get the concept that they are the ones that Desaad is pissed at because they've lost his heroin and now they have to go track it down. And meanwhile, Cassidy and Jesse are staying at Cassidy's girlfriend's place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
It gets revealed. That's where the heroin overdose gets revealed. That's where Cassidy basically, you know, says, and there's a really good speech here about him becoming immortal and sort of having to deal with how other people have aged around him and how it sort of has made them uncomfortable. You know what I mean? So
he implies pretty heavily here that it makes them more uncomfortable than it makes him. And, you know, we get that sense of him rolling around in the 60s, having rolled around for the century.
Yeah.
And we're still in that place where, you know, Cassidy's life seems just sort of like a wild, fun romp.
Yeah.
And it's just part of all of that. Just the wacky Zelig-esque, he met everybody, knew everybody sort of experience.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because you sort of get a hint of like, because I mean, he even says like, she didn't like me seeing her age. And he's like, to tell the truth, I didn't like it either. You know what I mean? And it's very, there's a little bit of melancholy in there where you're like, oh, okay. Like, but also a twinge of maybe selfishness in there, you know, where he says that it's interesting because I feel like, and you know, as Cassidy's character gets developed later on down the line, that's sort of very much a hint of like, there's remorse, but there's also like, why doesn't the world revolve around what I want a little bit?
Exactly.
So it's interesting. It's kind of, there's a lot of really good dialogue in this arc, and they drop a lot of like little hints, especially hindsight being 2020, that I probably was completely oblivious about when I was first reading the book, you know?
Yeah. I mean, totally. I mean, even this, which I didn't remember, I vaguely do remember, and like, I remember reading it, you know, when I first read it, but of course it's colored by, you know, almost 20 years. Jeez.
It's been 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Of the knowledge and of knowing it, that, you know, when he brings up the heroin, he implies that he doesn't outright say that he didn't do it.
Yeah.
But what he says about it is that it's for bloody idiots, that stuff, I should know.
Leaving
that gap open for the fact that, you know, we learn much later that he was a hardcore junkie.
Definitely. Yeah. It's they're really dropping breadcrumbs here, and you're sort of like, oh wow, now that I've read the series. Because I don't remember the specifics because it's been so long since I read the whole series, but I definitely remember some of that. And I remember that there's some sort of revelation that has to deal with his drug use where you're like, oh, Jesus, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it's like really bad. But we'll eventually get to that.
We'll get there.
What cracks me up about this sequence, and this is the sequence with the cat, where the cat drives me. I fully remember reading an interview with Steve Dillon, or an article, or maybe it was in one of these letter pages or something, where Steve mm-hmm. Dillon like apologizes for the way he draws animals or something. And he's like, oh, I couldn't draw a cat to save my life or something. And the cat it's hysterical, because now that I know that he was insecure about drawing a cat, like, I'm definitely like, yeah, that cat kind of looks kind of mangy, you know, but he's meant to be. So,
yeah. Yeah. But he also, like, it's interesting how he manages to avoid drawing the cat.
Yeah. 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 Exactly.
The cat is like out of frame or blocked by someone's body, that you don't really get to see the full cat ever.
Yeah.
But this whole, I mean, talk about farce. This whole bit is just hysterical.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, where they kick the cat around and he ends up kicking the wall by accident, and that's where they find the safe that contains the heroin.
Yep.
Yep.
And it turns out that the safe has an explosive...
that's right.
...has a trigger on it that would explode if he just opens it.
Yep.
And the combination is on the cat's collar.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And the cat won't go near them. And that's right. That's right. And then Cassidy gets knocked out the window because they're chasing the cat, and he kind of like trips and he falls out the window. Yeah. Yeah. Into the sunlight. Yeah. I'm seeing it now.
Yeah. Yeah. It becomes a whole very, very crazy bit.
Yep. 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 And there's a little bit more of Star and Featherstone in this issue.
That's right.
And
learn what the Grail's about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is it, right? Is this where he reveals like what the they're there to protect the bloodline, the pure bloodline of Jesus Christ, apparently has been inbred since the beginning of time, since the beginning of, you know, whatever, his supposed death. And is this where he goes into how the death was faked? Or
This is where, like, it's interesting how they very skillfully lay this out, because they don't even say that it's the bloodline of Christ yet.
That's right. They
just imply that he just says that it's they've protected the most important human bloodline on Earth for 1,946 years.
Yeah.
And that the Armageddon is coming in 2000 AD.
Yeah.
And that there will be chaos, and at the height of it, they will bring forth this Messiah,
the true
Son of our Lord in heaven. And then he implies that that kid will be killed immediately.
Because
I love this line: the masses will be lucky to get water into urine.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely heavily implied, and we find out later on that. I mean, we know what inbreeding leads to, so that he's not. And so this is part of the reason, whether you find out about it now or later on in this arc, why they want Jesse, because they know that he has something like the word. They don't know exactly what it is, or we don't know where they're getting their information from. They know about Jesse, but they think that he will be sort of the savior that will give the Grail the apocalypse that they want, or the leadership that they want when the apocalypse comes.
Star, so as we're learning here, and as we've learned before, that Star is a very high up figure in the Grail.
Yeah,
he's the second in command, and he has decided to alter their goals. And that's, you know.
Yeah, the Jesse thing is his plan. Yeah.
It's his plan and his plan alone, having discovered that they've been tracking him.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That they've been keeping they were keeping tabs on him for a while, and then he went off the radar, right? Mm-hmm. And they haven't seen him since. And then I guess did they come in contact with him or no? Here, he's got the picture of Jesse when he was younger, right?
There's a picture. For some reason, there's a picture of Jesse in the Grail's files,
yeah,
the Allfather's files going back to 1975.
Yeah.
And then he tells her a few pages on from here that for some reason that no one seems to know, they began surveillance, vigilance on Custer after the events in Anvil. And he has, oh, right, because there's another thing he implies here, which is wonderful, that he has information, or they have information on Jesse about his abilities, about the word, from another source.
Oh, that's like later in the book, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's So in a couple pages, we get to like the full story of how he's been tracking Jesse and why he's so fixated that Jesse should be the person revealed as the Messiah.
Yeah.
When the Armageddon starts.
Yeah. And this is when, you know, a lot of things haven't kicked into overdrive, but, you know, they finally get their hands on the cat and they open up the box and it is basically wired with dynamite. And there's like several bags of heroin, and the Bob Glover and Freddie Allen have their card in the safe. So, and they also threw the cat in the toilet. They threw the cat in the toilet and put a plant on top of it.
That's
which
right,
is pretty hysterical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. It's so abusive.
Yeah.
But and, it's okay. It's okay. It's fine.
And so a lot of this issue, like you said, I mean, it's very sort of setting up the way things are going to go, not just for this arc, but there's a lot of explanations about particularly Star's motives, right? And I think this is the issue where, you know, his sort of planning, his sort of motivation takes center stage for the most part.
Yes. I mean, it's mostly about Star and what's going on with him. While Jesse and Cassidy's sort of investigation into how Cassidy's girlfriend wound up with the heroin and has died start overlapping, and they start sort of aiming towards each other. And here is, we do come to the most interesting overlap of these two stories, and one with long reverberating repercussions, particularly for our hair Star, and is another part of the very weird humor and the very sexual shenanigans that mark what makes Preacher so wonderful.
Hair Star basically has a piquant for prostitutes.
And
what's his face? Not Featherstone, said, the other one.
Hoover. He says Hoover of all people.
Who has no experience whatsoever with anything. Yeah, exactly. He sends Hoover, the Laurel of the bunch, who keeps screwing up left and right, to go find him a prostitute.
Hoover, who can't say the word motherfucker.
Exactly.
Because he's so pious.
Yes.
He sends him to find prostitutes. The prostitutes take the measure of him pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And play a joke on him by giving him Hoover, by giving him Glover and Allen's card.
Yes. Which it turns out that their services are not just investigating.
No, they are not. Nope. They are. There is, again, a wonderful sense of farce in that Hoover is asking for a certain thing.
Yeah.
And the language that he's using doesn't match to what Hoover, that Glover and Allen do. There's a little bit of a suggestion that he may be accidentally setting Star up to be killed, but that's not what happens.
No. I mean, I think it's on Hoover's part. It's all of it is completely innocent. You know what I mean?
And
it's interesting that, because like the whole thing with the with the sexual investigators with Glover, I believe it is where I mean, basically what it is that Hare Star gets raped in an alleyway by Glover.
That's right, he does.
Because I I'm not sure like what Star's expectations were. Like, was it supposed to be something salacious with like female prostitutes? Like, that's the thing that I never get into it. Like, were they supposed to do what? Like, sexually assault him? Like, that's his fantasy? That's what he's into?
No, I mean, Star, we learn later that Star, God, Star is such an interesting, weird, complicated creature. That Star, who is like a virtual sociopath and has a host of sort of emotional problems.
Oh, yeah.
Can only be sexually gratified by being in the most degrading to the other person situations.
Okay.
Not to spoil it, but there's a point in a later arc when we really
I
dig into
remember this. Yeah, yeah.
We
yeah.
dig into Star's past, where he's having sex. He only wants to have sex with prostitutes because he's not interested in human relationships at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And purely for the purpose of sexual gratification. And at a certain point, he asks the prostitute to put her head in a toilet because whatever they're doing is simply not filthy enough.
Oh, so. God.
He has sent Hoover to find, you know, the filthiest prostitute available, which Hoover did find, and they sent him to Glover and Allen, former rent boys and now sexual investigators.
Well, it's just interesting to me how this would sort of unfold, and he's like, no, don't do this, and he does it anyway. So, so it's like, I guess the understanding is that your job is to go sexually assault a man and don't stop no matter what. Like, that's what I was kind of like, how does that unfold? But whatever.
And I mean, there is a bit of a suspension of disbelief you have to buy into this because Hair Star is one of the deadliest characters in this book.
That's true.
We've already seen him shoot not just someone in the head without at the drop of a hat, but shoot his boss in the head at the drop of a hat. And so it does stretch it a little bit to think that he would allow this to happen, but he does.
Yeah,
Again, it's in this farcical sort of place here.
Yeah.
And we get, you know, another little moment of farce where Glover and Allen show up at Cassidy's girlfriend's apartment to retrieve their box.
Yes.
But because it's daylight, Cassidy is stuck under the bed until the sun goes down.
Yeah.
And is unable to stop them or take his revenge then.
Yeah, exactly.
But he learns where they're going, so they're all on their way there.
Yeah, absolutely. And the next issue opens up with Star basically assaulting Hoover because he's like, what does he say? You turned me into a homosexual. And her comment is like, I really don't think that's how it works. It's like, okay.
Yes.
And the only way that he's able to stop Hoover from getting killed by Star is by letting him know that they found Custer.
Exactly. Hoover's connections in the SFPD picked up on Custer at the bar brawl. And that's literally the only way. Though again, all of these events have long-standing effects on poor. In some ways, Hair Star is like the most tragic character in this.
He's the most pathetic. He ends up kind of being the most pathetic.
All of these terrible things happen to him, and he deserves all of them because he's a stone cold sociopath and a total monster.
Yeah.
But he comes in, he's a total badass, and over the course of the series, he has all of that stripped away.
Yeah.
Along with several very key body parts. Just made to look ridiculous. More and more. As the series continues.
Yeah. I don't know how they're going to address Star in the show. I don't know,
but I think it's going to be a great part. I mean,
whoever gets it is going to have to do a really good job. If you miscast that, that's like unforgivable, you know?
The show, because he is the number one villain for the rest of this thing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and at this point, Jesse and Jesse and Cassidy are sort of closing in on the sexual investigators. They find a bunch of other guys who turns out are looking for the sexual investigators, and they interrogate them as well.
Yep. And that's how they find out about Jesus de Sade.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah. And I mean, that is a really great scene too, when they find the guy and they basically tie him up with tape. And they basically are interrogating him. And it's funny because the guy unknowingly insults Cassidy's ex-girlfriend, and Cassidy has like a big freak out about it. You know, and so you sort of get the idea that he really cared about this person in a way. Right. Yeah.
And he does. I think he did in his own Cassidy way.
Yeah.
And he feels, you know, I mean, Cassidy is so guilt-ridden from all the things he's done. I think he feels more responsible that, you know, that she died of heroin when, you know, in all likelihood, he got her hooked on the stuff.
Yeah, probably.
And so he wants that sort of satisfaction. But it's great because, you know, like Cassidy and Jesse work the guy over, and they work him over in their sort of their own way. And they're kind of gentle. They're mean, but gentle, and with just punches. And then the poor guy falls into the hands of Hair Star, who immediately shoots him in the leg.
Yes, exactly. And the kneecap, like, basically, you know, pulls like old gangster style. And what's great here is that Hoover immediately gets his redemption. You know what I mean? Where it's like he basically saves Hair Star's life, you know?
He does.
Yeah.
He totally does save Hair Star's life and gets literally no credit for it. Yeah. That's how much of a dick Hair Star is.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hoover shoots this guy in the head, and his first Hair Star's first line back to him is, "Who taught you to shoot?"
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But he has a point, because he's like, "I never fired a gun at someone in my life," you know, but he saves his life. And then Hair Star is like, not even thankful. He's like, "Well, it would have been nice to be able to question him." You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
That's great.
I think that is really, I mean, that whole sequence. And then as soon as they're done, Hoover starts puking and ruins any sort of maybe subtle respect that Hair Star had for him in any way for saving his life.
Yep, it's all gone.
Yep, it's all gone. And then we get to the party.
And then everyone gets to the party, and it is as debaucherous as you can imagine.
This is like them. They get to the party. They're splitting up. They're looking for, well, originally they're looking for Jesus de Sade, because they want to sort of figure out what the connection is with the heroin and stuff like that. He was supposed to get the heroin from the investigators and stuff like that. And there's a lot of like little hijinks, this little panel where the woman is like, "Bite me, hit me, bite me. I want you to bite me," to Cassidy. And he's like, "Nah, you don't." You know, Jesse sneaks into a room, and there's a guy, like, I don't even know what that contraption is. He's stuck in a, what is that called?
It's the stockade.
The stockade. That's right. Okay. Yeah, that's right. And then in a room full of sheep.
Sheep. And he's like calling the sheep sluts.
He's like,
what's happening?
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely the most messed up, like, sort of hysterical thing. And then Jesse finally runs into Jesus, and it's like, at first, well, you're wondering, like, he's got this brown glop on his face,
all over his arm,
and you're sort of just like, oh, please don't tell me that he's been doing what I think he's been doing. But it turns out to have been, or at least he claims it is, ice cream.
Ice cream.
Yeah,
exactly. Or double fudge.
Yeah, double fudge chocolate choco chip. And basically has a conversation with Jesse for a little bit. And what I love in this sequence is the stuff that's happening in the background while he's talking to Jesus. You know, and it happens in a lot of panels, not just these, where there's like naked people walking by. There's like a guy with a policeman's hat and a small like little tree plant like walking past. And then there's like a guy with a teddy bear. Like, they're talking, and there's all these like crazy like little sort of I don't know what you would call it, like laughing, like little detail, like skits going on in the background, like, you know. It's hysterical. It's pretty funny stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
And what's great about this is that until he learns that it's Jesus de Sade, they're actually having a really, and this is, again, a beauty of this book, is that it sort of curls up these relatively sort of radical philosophical conversations in the midst of all of this, where, you know, Jesse is actually not against what's going on here as long as no one's getting hurt.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, what? It doesn't matter. Like, you know, what? And, but he's also not the kind of person who's like, oh, I'm shocked by all of this. Like, I don't care. It's like, whatever people need to do, they do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think in the next issue, you definitely get more of a sense of like, it grows old really fast to them.
Yeah,
like they're
yeah.
at first they're like, wow, what is all this crazy stuff? And then it just becomes like, ugh, really? Like, and then, you know, you sort of get the sense of like, it definitely becomes about wealthy people and like them having more time and money on their hands than they deserve. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Which is kind of like a really good turn that to take, because I mean, it really, I mean, there is, there's definitely a thing about like consenting adults, but it's, the thing is like anything gets old, like really fast, like once you're exposed to it too much, and they start to look around and see like, yeah, these people are just idiots. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have nothing else to do.
Gross.
Yeah. And nothing to contribute to society, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, and then at the end of this issue, well, he has a pretty interesting conversation, you know, about the parties and stuff like that with Jesus de Sade. And then he goes to find Cassidy and he's like, stay right here.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Herr Starr's troops are out, you know, ready to raid the place.
Yep, exactly. Herr Starr has lined up a bunch of mercenaries and freelancers. They've tracked Jesse here and they're coming in to nab Jesse.
Yeah.
That's their one goal.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. Exactly. And the next issue is the one where the stuff starts to go down.
Yep. The next issue, it all comes to a head.
Yeah. I love that cover of Tula.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a good cover. Oh, my God. Well, Glenn Fabry's covers during the whole thing are just like great. I love this. I love this first page. Let's fist again like we did last summer. Let's fist again like we did. It's just this guy in boxing glove and boxer shorts, and he's just like having the greatest time.
What is happening at this party? Which is which is the splash page, like the title page of the comic.
It's Judgment Night.
We're going, what are these people doing?
Yeah, exactly. He's just like so shocked that so many people would gather in the, and that's actually a really good page too. It's really funny because, you know, Dylan is really good at being slightly sexually explicit, but not going overboard at all. But sort of almost being tasteful in a way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's fairly mellow. In especially, you know, in terms, I mean, geez, even things in some comic books I really like go a lot further.
Oh yeah. Well, it's interesting. I love this, the opening sequence, because, everyone's like, okay, we're going to go look for Jesse and, you know, try and find this guy. And Hoover, I think, is a little bit like, well, like, how do we do this, like, subtly, or how do we take care of all this? And Herr Starr's like, this is great. Like, what are they going to do? Like, if we start shooting people, are they going to call the police? I don't think so. You know what I mean? He's just like, hardly. He's like, we've got free reign. You know,
this great art isn't safe at our own orgies anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So. It was terrible, officer. There I was, jamming a syringe full of heroin into my eyeball while filleting a billy goat when these men burst in and started shooting people. Exactly. It's just,
oh,
like,
God.
He's like, what are they going to do? Call the police? Yeah, exactly.
Another great trait of Herr Starr is those little speeches he gets to give.
Yeah, the sarcasm.
The sarcasm and the, in some ways he's almost like what's his name? McGinley's character on Scrubs, where it's just, he has a long, withering, sarcastic response to
you're
anything.
Right. Yeah, you're right. That's a good call. That's a really good call. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's a really good call. But then yeah. Tulip gets word that these guys are there. I love the sexual investigators being sort of like the wallflowers at the party.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. Like, that's just genius.
Sad bastards.
Oh my God. They're just like, just face it. Nobody wants it. Like, we reek of like common man or whatever.
Exactly.
None of these people, you know, want to do anything with us. And you know, and in the meanwhile, Jesse and Cassidy are still getting into like little weird hijinks. Cassidy's throwing people over stair rails just for the fun of it, and Jesse punches this artist guy out who asked him to pose for his
stair.
Yeah,
pose
yeah.
for his painting.
Yeah, called The Abyss or something. I don't know. Yeah, my Gaze into the Abyss piece, which happens to involve it looks like an overweight woman, possibly naked. We won't even get into that. Moving on.
All those details, it's all terrible and crazy.
Yeah. Oh, and here's the sequence where stuff gets like really serious, you know?
Yeah.
And now
it takes the turn.
Now it takes the turn that I kind of mentioned before, where this is like, it was all fun and games, exactly, until someone gets hurt. And you come across Jesus de Sade, and he's basically shooting a grown-up film. Unfortunately, the grown-up film involves a child being molested. And that's where Jesse's like, no. Like, I'm not, which would any other normal person would, you know, do the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
And he just goes, starts beating the crap out of Jesus.
Yeah, he just starts beating the ever loving crap out of him.
He uses
the word really for the first time in a while on Jesus's bodyguard to just allow him more time to beat the crap out of Jesus.
Yep, exactly. So, I mean, this is when it all starts to come to a head, because Tulip actually approaches Hoover with a gun. And Star, basically, they start shooting each other, and Cassidy runs into the sexual investigators.
That's right. So, yeah, our three heroes are actually at this point fairly well split up.
Yeah,
where
exactly.
Tulip is alone dealing with Star and the Grail's henchmen, while Cassidy gets sort of caught up, literally, sexual investigators' hands.
Yeah.
And just in time for the big comic parody of Bob Glover saying it's buggering time.
Well, oh my God. He says, because I was reading this and I was like, oh my God. He goes, okay, true believer. And then he goes, it's buggering time. Because basically Cassidy punches the other guy in the face. His fist, he hits him so hard that his fist gets stuck in his skull and he can't pull it out, and this freaking other guy is like, oh, I'm just gonna take this advantage to basically rape Cassidy. And it's like,
exactly,
and my brain is going like, what is the thought process? Like, your friend just got his face caved in. Like, what are you doing?
But the great part about like the face caving in is actually part of the strategy, because they make a point of, oh my God, this is also terrible, talking about, you know, how strong basically his mouth and his suction is from his time as a rent boy.
Cassidy
can't get his hand out.
Oh my God. It's just so demented.
Swallowed Cassidy's hand whole.
Yeah. Well, and then there's also that part where he's like, that's it, Freddy lad, hold the bastard.
Exactly.
Like, he's doing it on purpose. He's basically like holding on to his hand in his, it's just so bizarre. It's really bizarre. And then cut to Tulip, which this is a really amazingly well drawn sequence.
You know, man.
It's funny because a lot of the stuff that's going on in this particular issue reminded me a lot of True Romance when I was reading it. I was like, especially the climactic scene at the end of True Romance, which is a movie I'm going to have to rewatch soon, because that is a great flick. But
so good.
Yeah, I mean, it very much reminded me of that sort of thing where it was, you know, the shootout, and it's like, it looks like there's no way out. And she just basically, I mean, this is one of those sequences in the series which shows you how badass Tulip is. You know what I mean? Because she's kind of been badass for much of the beginning of the story, but this is where you sort of get the feeling that she can really, really handle herself.
Oh my God. I mean, this is intense, because I mean, she's outgunned. It's like four guys with heavy machinery.
Yep.
You know, semi-automatics and automatic weapons, and she has one pistol.
Yep.
And she takes them all out, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a fantastic sequence. And then you get a little bit into her history at the end where she just says, "Thanks, Dad."
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's so intense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen the clip that's been circulating from the show.
No.
From Preacher.
Oh, there's a
clip.
Go ahead.
Where Tulip, it's a version of, you know, the hit that we see in her first arc, but it's extended so that now she's driving in a car.
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to, like, kill this guy, and they wind up fighting in the back seat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As the car is, like, careening through a cornfield.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this has that feeling. Like, that scene still has this same, that same sort of over-the-top kind of violence.
Yeah.
But Tulip is still just unbelievably tough and hardcore.
It's really funny because in comics you'd think things would be sort of more spectacular, and to me this is sort of a more kind of realistic sequence, because she's hiding, she's having a shootout, whereas, you know, I watched that sequence in online and I was like, and I, you know, I'm still, you know, basically having trouble processing the actress as Tulip, but at the same time, I'm like, this sort of like action sequence is very sort of like high action and is not sort of the tone that I expect, you know, at a Preacher. I kind of expect more of a, I don't know, Taxi Driver, sort of gritty, like more based in reality sort of thing. So for me, it was very hard to process that clip where I was like,
And see, I felt the other way. I felt like it captured, like, even it doesn't have the total feel of this, but even that moment, there's just a great little moment right from the beginning where she's cowering behind the thing and she's like, front sight,
yeah,
here we go, and then she's just like unleashes, and it's just, I don't know, it has that intensity for me.
Yeah, I get it. I totally get it. And
you know, she shoots one of these guys in the crotch and then in the head. Yeah, like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Yeah. I mean, this is definitely one of those chapters where it's like, yeah, she can definitely take care of herself.
Right.
You know, and it's, and you know, in a way it almost gets, it doesn't get negated, but it gets diminished a little bit when she has to be saved by Cassidy. You know what I mean?
Right.
Where she has that the final shootout with Star, and she basically runs out of bullets, and Cassidy has to fake his way into pretending that he's Jesse Custer so that they can, you know, so they can survive, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that she can survive, and more importantly.
Yeah, exactly.
And we also want to know, we get the beginning of the destruction of Hairstar, who loses his ear to Tulip.
Yeah, he gets his ear shut off. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But he doesn't even flinch.
Nope. No, he does not. I mean, he's a tough bastard.
He is a tough bastard. Yeah.
Oh, no, the ridiculous of Cassidy's fake English Southern accent.
Yeah, exactly.
God damn it.
Yeah, I love that panel because he's got like the buck tooth sort of like sticking out, sort of like he's trying to be like a redneck, like a dummy. But they fall for it. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
In the meantime, Jesse is kicking the crap out of Desaad, and that panel at the end is just amazing, where he basically told Desaad's henchmen in the other sequence to eat his gun. And the guy is basically chewing his gun, and it's all bloody. And oh my God. But it's just like, this is another sequence that very much establishes Jesse is like, you don't want to mess around with him. You don't want to piss him off. But with a very deep sort of moral code again.
Right. You know, him beating Desaad and saying, how do you like feeling totally helpless?
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow. Like that's, oof.
Yeah. And then another sort of you know, Star escapes in two vans, mm-hmm. one with Tulip and one with Cassidy, and, you know, more hysterics where, you know, Bob has gotten thrown onto a car without his pants.
And clinging to the roof.
Yeah, he's clinging to the roof while Jesse, a roof of a car, while Jesse is in hot pursuit in his car trying to save Cassidy and Tulip. And it's just a brilliant sequence. You know?
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, he catches the van that's got Tulip in it.
Yeah.
Who chokes out Hoover with her leg.
Yeah, exactly.
She's Tulip O'Hare and is the toughest of them all.
Yeah, slams her head into the side of the door of the van. Yeah, and and the other guy's left in the tree. But yeah. Hoover and Featherstone have been captured by Tulip and Jesse, and and they're in hot pursuit at the end of this issue, which is really funny because it's listed as four issues on the very first, you know, part of it, but then they have this epilogue, which sort of kind of caps everything off, which I found a little bit odd. I thought I was done, and then I got and I was like, oh, to be continued. And it's called Hunter's Epilogue. Yeah.
Yep. The epilogue where they sort of tie up the last things, and we get again that Hoover. Well, one, we get more great comedy of Cassidy pretending to be Jesse.
Yeah, absolutely.
Poorly.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And then.
Well, Star reveals the big plan. Like, this is where everything just gets laid out. Because he believes that first of all, they take him to this place called Masada, right?
France.
Yeah. But it's in France. Yeah. Yeah. And this is where he kind of like lays out his plan. And you sort of get the sense that as big a deal as her Star thinks he is in the organization or his like web of deceit, that he on the home turf, he really has to sort of tiptoe around.
Right. Yeah. Cause I think in this, we actually meet Allfather Daronique and
I didn't see that.
It's not in this one. It's next. Yeah. They mention him and we get the sense of that he is a terrible, terrible, terrible creature.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But yeah, he starts getting the sense, you know, we learn that they guard the blood of the lamb and that, you know, all of this, the legend of the Grail, the Holy Grail is where we're at.
Yeah. The legend of the Holy Grail, basically that they are protecting the bloodline of Christ and that Herr Star has the plan to use Jesse to sort of subvert the plan of the organization so that he can supplant the actual descendant of Christ with Jesse so that they when the end time comes he can have his savior in place, somebody that will be able to bend the people to his will.
Right.
Yeah.
That is exactly the thing.
I love this bit where Star says, "I want you to be the new Messiah to Cassidy." And he goes, "Oh, fucking great. I mean, blessed are the meek." It's so great. It's such a great line.
It's so funny.
Yeah,
it's all so great. And then we also get the great bit of comedy. Well, dark comedy. Because Jesse and Tulip still have Hoover and Featherstone.
Yes.
Hoover is smart enough, or Featherstone's smart enough to get away from them.
Yes, she jumps out of a moving car. Yeah, yeah. Which Jesse respects.
The presence of mind to cover her ears.
Yeah.
So she can't hear Jesse call for her.
Exactly. She hides in the bush on the side of the road, and Jesse goes out to follow her and he uses the word, but she covers her ear. That is a beautifully drawn panel. Like the look on her face, the shrubbery around her and him looking around. There's something about that panel that, you know, Dylan, I mean, look, we've said it in other podcasts, but Dylan nails it. I mean, just his storytelling is on the characters, like the facial expression, like everything. It's just, he's fantastic. And that, for some reason, that one panel to me, out of this whole sequence just like sticks out, because you yep. can, you get the sense of fear, the tension in her shoulders, the, you know, she's scared.
Yep, exactly. You get all of that, and you get all of, even the resignation of Jesse.
Yeah.
And like you said, the grudging sort of respect for Featherstone.
Yep.
To get away from him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
yeah, comes, and then comes the moment. Yeah. Which is just like the most, God. The end. Of, yeah, 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 yeah. Go ahead.
So he just, how he dispatches with poor Hoover is he takes him to a beach and tells him, using the word, to count the grains of sand until he reaches 3 million.
Yes. On the beach. He drops him off on the beach by the side of the road.
Yeah.
And because it is California. Yeah.
I've always loved this part.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Hoover, of course, protests having to do this.
Yeah.
And Jesse says to him, wages of sin, Hoove. He's like, what was my sin? Fucking with me and mine. Get to it. Like,
yeah. And you know what the great part about this is, like, when I was reading it, I was like, Hoover is probably the least sort of mercenary of them all. Like, he's the nice, like, if you were going to pick a nice guy out of this crazy organization that is, you know, like, he's the guy that you would be like, oh, I feel bad for this guy, you know?
Yeah.
So it makes it doubly, or maybe even more triply, if that's even an expression, like harsh, because you're just like, oh man, that guy's kind of just along for the ride. He's just a putz.
Exactly. He's literally like the least harmful person to them.
Yeah.
In this entire thing.
Yes.
And he receives this. This is the payment he receives for that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh gosh, you know, you just feel so bad for him, because I mean, that's an awful punishment to put on anybody, but he's definitely sort of the schlub that kind of got roped into everything. You feel bad for him. But and you know, the rest of this issue is very much like great sequence where Hairstar tries to get Cassidy to use the word on this French gardener who is lame. And, you know, I mean, it hasn't really been like this really set off a whole bunch of questions for me, because, you know, basically what he tries to get Jesse, Cassidy, he thinks he's Jesse, to use the word to get this guy to be able to walk.
Right.
You know, basically, like, if he says, he thinks that if Jesse can say, which we don't even know that that's part of it. All we know is that you would want to do what he says for you to do. And I was like, man, if that was part of the power, could Jesse like get somebody to come back from the dead? Could he, could he prevent them from dying? Could he be like if somebody was dying, could he just be like, don't die, and they don't die?
I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question.
Like, how far does it go?
That's another question, because he can make someone die.
That's true.
Like, that's true. He told what's his name to die.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he could, if Jesse were here, I don't know that he would have he might have gotten a different response. Like, the guy might have been able to walk.
Who knows? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is I don't think that level was ever tested, you know, and it's kind of interesting that Star would be the one to think of that, you know, and be like, get this guy to walk. Because I mean, you know, then you're just like, you're in the money, because nobody can die around you. You could just be like, no, just live, don't die. But they don't ever really test that theory in this series. But, you know, in any case, like, Cassidy obviously fails in his attempt. And
fails miserably.
He fails miserably because the old man falls flat on his face as he lets the crutches go. And I love Cassidy. It doesn't always work the first time.
I also love Star's retort to them. Is it me, or is your accent starting to slip?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh boy.
I've been had. But then we sort of get to, it doesn't end well for Cassidy at this point.
No.
Yeah.
No, it does not.
Yeah.
Because then we again get the intimation of the secret prisoner that Star is keeping, that's his source of intel on Jesse.
Yeah, that's right.
in the secret room 99.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, there's no spoilers here, that no spoilers for a 20-year-old comic book.
Yeah, I know, right?
Cassidy sees in room 99 scares the bejesus out of him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Literally.
Yeah.
And also gets him shot with a machine gun.
Yes, yes. Gets him shot.
And then with many, many machine guns.
And this is sort of the sequence that I had a little bit of a problem with, because... or the area where I had a little bit of a problem with, because there's a part of me that's like, why is Cassidy scared? I mean, this guy is immortal. He's super strong. He's probably faster than any of them. Why can't he just take them out? You know what I mean?
I mean, I think, well, the thing we get, and we come to it in the next part of this arc, in what the arc they call Proud Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the thing is that all of these things do hurt.
Yeah.
Like, it hurts Cassidy in the same way that it hurts anyone to be shot.
Yeah.
And it weakens him. So I feel like that's the thing, is that Star shoots him so much so quickly that he physically can't overcome Star and all of his guys.
Yeah. But I mean, even before that, to me, I feel like Cassidy just could have cleaned house with everybody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I know that he can't outrun a machine gun, but, and I suppose you're right, it's the shock of him seeing whatever it is he sees in that room.
Right.
But
that stops him here.
Yeah, even before that, I get the feeling, because there's a part of me, I feel, earlier in the run, you know, you sort of get the sense that not only is Cassidy, like, I mean, I don't think he's like the Flash fast. Not only is he stronger, but I think he's slightly faster than your average normal human being. So there's a part of me where I'm like, well, why don't you just kick everybody's ass? You know what I mean? Take everybody out, you know? And because God knows he's been able to do it before, but for some reason, it's like he's oddly intimidated by Star and his troops.
Yeah.
Or I mean, maybe he thinks that they still have Tulip. I guess that's the explanation.
He does think they still have Tulip for most of this.
Yeah, yeah.
He thinks that they still have Tulip so that she's protecting her.
Yeah.
For most of this, which is why he's sort of playing along. And I guess he's also sort of assuming that Jesse will, he's doing this and Jesse will come and save him eventually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think it is mostly that Cassidy thinks he can get out of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the way I've always thought of it. That, like, he thinks he's going to be able to talk his way out of this like he talks his way out of most things.
Yeah.
Until it's far too late.
Until it's far too late. And then I think, which leads us to, I think this was kind of the best sequence in this whole run, which is, you know, Tulip and Jesse, well, one of, you know, in bed together, they're getting ready to head to Paris to save Cassidy. And it's basically Jesse, like, trying to talk Tulip out of going because he doesn't want her to get killed.
Right.
And her being like, I'm not going to put up with that. And it's just some like really good dialogue and a really good back and forth between the two of them. And quite honestly, I'm looking at it right now. Dude, this is like 4, almost 5 pages of two people in bed having a conversation, you know?
Yep.
And it's just like so well done.
So well done. And it's so ballsy to have that. It's so ballsy to have this entire conversation just happen.
Yeah.
You know, and then both making their good points, because I mean, largely the point here is that Jesse is worried he won't be able to protect Tulip wherever they're going. And Tulip's point is, I don't need you to protect me.
Yeah.
And their evidence for both is the same. Their evidence is, you know, his evidence is, I wasn't there to protect you. And her star nearly got you.
Yeah.
And her point is, you weren't there to protect me, and I killed all those guys. And you came in, like, I didn't need you to save me.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But his point also is, you needed someone because Cassidy had to come and help you. So, so I mean, they both have good points. But at the end of the day, what you're getting is that Jesse is kind of, I mean, he is sort of a chauvinist in his own way, where it's like he feels like, and he cops to it. You know what I mean? He cops to, you know, feeling like he's the man, and he has to be responsible, and he has to sort of help take care of her and make sure she never gets hurt. And right. But what he doesn't realize is, like, he's being like, well, that's her choice, right? If she's gonna screw up, it's got to be her mistake, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's her choice to come along. And I like her point, which is also that, like, well, if you're worried about not having my back, then just have my back and we'll be okay.
Yeah, yeah, like, exactly.
Don't worry about it. The two of us together, we can take care of it.
Yeah.
Don't run off on me again.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We'll be fine.
Yeah, and it's a super great sequence because it's just more character building. It's sort of more developing their relationship, more sort of like setting where they stand. Because they have had a little bit of this conversation before, but it's definitely sort of more now, like the more that they're in it together, the more that their relationship has solidified. Because before they were sort of at each other's throats. I mean, they kind of, they cared for each other. But now it's like Jesse's, and she's already been killed once. You know, so he does have a point. Like, I don't want you to get killed. But at the same time, she's like not willing to let him go off on his own.
On his own. Yeah. It's her it's her journey, too. It's I mean, again, it's just really, really brave to, like, have this long conversation in a comic book that, you know, just a few issues before was, you know, talking about sodomizing an armadillo.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that leads to, you know, Cassidy just getting blown to smithereens.
But here I think we get to that point where, so a star has shot up Cassidy, thinks he's dead.
Yeah.
Cassidy very smartly waits until the guys get closer and attacks them.
Yeah.
And he kills two of the guys before everyone starts unloading on him and actually dismember him.
Yeah, yeah.
To stop him again.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like that's the reason why he is not, as fast as he is, he's not able to wade through that many heavily armed guys.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is they're kind of like, they're all, I just think there would have been a different point, not this particular spot, because I mean, there is basically a firing squad. Like, no one's going to get out of that unless you're like the Flash or Superman. Right. But I mean, he, you know, I think he could have had plenty of opportunities to take somebody out, try and escape, you know what I mean? And I just feel like he didn't, but I think I very much clarified my own question, which was that he thought that Tulip was being held too, and he didn't want them to do anything. So, but yeah, this is a pretty gruesome sequence. I mean, he gets his arm shot off, but he goes down fighting, you know, and it's great because one sequence is his right hand is up. He's missing two fingers. It's basically in chunks. And the guy's like, I think he's still alive.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, but you know, at least Star is smart enough to realize, like, okay, this isn't Custer, but Custer's coming.
Yep.
This isn't
Jesse.
Yes,
we do.
And then we get to the
it's just so sad.
The best, I'm sorry, I don't care. Like, in the history of all comic books, the best last page to a comic book ever. The best last page, which it's Hoover counting grains of sand on the beach, and he's getting close to a million, and then the wind and he's got a little stack of sand grains, and the wind blows the sand grains, and he just looks up, and tears roll down his cheek, and then he starts over.
That's
one, two, three, four. The best. This is one of those sequences, like in Preacher, that I remember reading it, and it's one of those things that you're just never gonna forget.
No,
you just never forget it.
With you.
Yeah,
oh, it's so sad. It's
just
so beautifully drawn.
It really is. It's just simple, but it's just like heartbreaking. And oh my God, it is probably the best page, one of the best pages in the whole series, where you're just like, oh my God, because like the punishment, like you get it, like when it comes down, you're like, oh man. But then to see like it play out, and then the wind to blow it away. And you know that this guy has such a fortitude, strength of character that he's not going to cheat it. And he's not just he's not going to be like, oh, I counted a I got up to a certain point. Why don't I just keep counting? He's got to start over. Why not
start there? Over. He's got to start over again from the beginning.
All right. Well, there you go. That is Hunters. Oh, I still love this series. I love it. I can't wait to keep reading it. So, any final thoughts on this or to wrap it up?
It's just so great to revisit because it's been a long time since I revisited it.
Yeah.
And I'm just so exciting to be a part of it, and not to be a part of it, but just to be connected to it again in this way. I'm just like so great.
so happy for this opportunity. I definitely am. I'm glad that I started this because I just love rereading it. And I honestly do not think I have reread it since the very first time I read it. I think at the last, when I read the last issue of Preacher, I was like, this was perfect. I'm not going to go back to it again. I think I was just like, this was a perfect reading experience, but I'm glad that I did because I honestly am having just as good a time now as I did last time. I mean, obviously I'm like 20 years older, you know, so there's a lot more insight, but it still is entertaining to me and I'm loving it. So
I'm so glad I've read it through a couple of times, and I'm actually very, very happy because, you know, I've been reading these issues digitally.
Yeah.
But I just got, and unfortunately I didn't have this collection, but I just got my almost entire collection back from storage in Austin.
That's great.
And so now I can go back and read my lovingly collected versions once again.
That's great.
And they make me so happy.
Yep. Well, that's awesome, man. Well, thank you for joining me on this chapter of Preacher. It's always great to have you on.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Yep. And you're still doing Deep Cut Nerd.
Yep. Deep Cut Nerd. New episodes generally drop on Mondays. So that's follow us on the Twitter at Deep Cut Nerd Pod.
Awesome.
And check out, the fun times with me and my buddy Larry.
Cool. Awesome. Well, this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. That is Jason Holtham. And I am Christian Horn. And hopefully I will be back with another episode next week. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just flying by the seat of my pants at this point, like I am every week. But thank you for listening. And we'll be back hopefully soon with the next chunk of Preacher. Either that or we're going to, I don't know, when does the show debut?
End of May. So
all right, we're going to do the next arc before that. We may have to start speeding things up. It may just become the Preacher podcast for the next couple of weeks. Who knows? But
I'm fine with that, and I hope fans enjoy it.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, and thanks for listening. bless you. Check us out. You know, follow us on Twitter at Part-Time Fanboy. And check out our Facebook page and send us an email, blah, blah, blah. Drop us a review on iTunes, all that good stuff. Thank you for listening and join us again soon. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time.